The Sports Illustrated Media Podcast is brought to you by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy football with more winners and more payouts than any other site. Listen up to this. This is important. Enter promo code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, at FanDuel.com for a bonus match of up to $200. We're also sponsored by the SeatGeek app, the easiest way to find a great deal, pay for your ticket, and get to your seats. The NFL season's coming up, so SeatGeek will be huge for you there. Download the SeatGeek app and enter our code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, for $20 off your first tickets.
You have to love the process that we're talking about here, because so much of it is about the process, you know, that preparation that goes into it. I think you have to love sports as it relates to sports television, because I didn't get into this business because I love television. I got into this business because I couldn't play center field for the Yankees, or, you know, number three forward for the Knicks or something like that. You know, that's what I really would have loved to do. So as a kid growing up, when I realized that pretty early, you know, I really kind of fixated on watching games on television and back then listening to games on the radio. And I thought for me, you know, that would be a way I could stay connected to sports.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview members of the sports media about their work and interesting people about the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Bette Marston. And this week, our guest is NBC Sports' Fred Godelli. He is the coordinating producer of Sunday Night Football. That is the showcase game for the National Football League each week on Sunday night. For a long time, that show has been the number one rated primetime show in the television season. It is a sports juggernaut. Most people believe that is also the best NFL production of them all. And Fred Godelli is at the top of the hierarchy, top of the pie chart on this. He is the producer who makes this engine go, probably has about 100, 150 people under his charge in a given week. Obviously is in the room with Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth and Michelle Tafoya for production meetings with the teams, with the players. He's been in that role, I think, since 2005. And so he is the point person for what many consider the best NFL broadcast on a weekly basis. He should be a really, really interesting guest. We'll be talking to him today in Los Angeles, California, where he will soon be heading to the Television Critics Association. I think every year they bring in all sorts of television people, and the television critics talk to them and generally write glowing stories about those participants. All right, Bette Marston does not like long intros. We will keep it short. Without further ado, here is Fred Godelli of NBC's Sunday Night Football. Okay, as promised, we bring in Fred Godelli. No, he is technically the coordinating producer of Sunday Night Football, but let's face it, he is basically the commandante of Sunday Night Football, or whatever title you want to give him. He is in Los Angeles as we tape this. He'll be talking to the television critics later today. I'm sure that will be a swimmingly good time for Mr. Fred Godelli. Fred, thank you very much for joining the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Rich, great to be here and great to be speaking with you.
I appreciate that. All right. You know, Fred, as you know, there's a lot of process that we talk about in this podcast, whether it's Adam Schefter's job or Rachel Nichols' job, and the many Bob Lee, Mike Mayock, and the many guests that we've had. We have not had many. If I think about it, you are the first producer who has done this podcast. And so I think for the listeners, this will just be interesting because many people really don't know what you do, both during a Sunday broadcast as well as during the week. So on a purely description term, let's start off with this. What does a coordinating or executive producer do for an NFL broadcast?
Well, I'll start with the football vernacular, and then we can expound from there as fine as you want to take it. I always tell people, and I usually put Drew Esikoff, our director, in the mix. I said, if we were a football team, me, the coordinating producer, would be the head coach of the team, and Drew would be the quarterback. And, you know, I've got about, 12 assistants that each have their own specific areas of responsibility, whether it be graphics or editing or replays or social media or what have you. And during the week, we set out a plan in all those areas of how we're going to cover the game. And then when the game begins, my main job is to talk with Al and Chris and Michelle and direct the editorial view of the game, while Drew is in there like the quarterback executing every play, every second of the game. So that's how I try to explain it to people who don't work in television or don't really understand what a producer and director does, and I'll take that as finally as you want to take it from here.
Yeah, we'll go with that. So in that construct, then, if you are the head coach, Drew Eskoff, who's a world-class director, is the quarterback, what does that make Chris Collinsworth and Al Michaels, who I think most people would, if you're going to sort of go on this layman's description, they would probably think that's the quarterback and the running back.
Yeah, and in a way they are. In a way they are, because it's a real dance between who's leading the telecast. I mean, the announcers lead the telecast for the most part. But, what the public doesn't see in a commercial, there'll be a discussion going on between Al and Chris and myself, and sometimes Michelle has to be in there depending on what the subject matter is. And, I'll take it for, the other night. So we're getting ready to do something. We're in the Hall of Fame game. And I said, hey, let's come out and talk about Super Bowl 50, the whole celebration, because in Super Bowl 9, when the Steelers and Vikings played, there were 15 players in that game that eventually went on to become Hall of Famers, and people probably don't know that. We have both those teams in the game. And they're like, yeah, let's do that. And then Chris goes, hey, maybe we ought to do Alejandro Villanueva. This kid from West Point who's trying to make the team as a left tackle, was an Army Ranger, got a Bronze Star for Valor for pulling guys out of a foxhole in Afghanistan. I'm like, hey, you know what? That's a better idea. Let's do that. And so there's that whole collaboration, that goes on constantly throughout the game, where you have a lot of, we've got, people who've, prepared immensely for 7 days, and now you're trying to unfold this broadcast in the construct of a game, although in preseason you don't have to stay as strictly to the game as you would in a regular season. But, it's a real collaboration. And, yes, at some point, in terms of what's being said on the air, and sometimes Al will take us in the direction the telecast is going to. Sometimes Chris will take us in the direction. Sometimes I will. And sometimes even Drew will by, some of the visuals he's able to find. So what would I call? I guess I would call Al and Chris. I mean, that's an interesting dilemma on how I would tab them, but they are obviously leading the broadcast as the play-by-play man and the color man, for most of the night.
What makes someone good at what you do?
You have to love the process that we're talking about here, because so much of it is about the process, that preparation that goes into it. I think you have to love sports as it relates to sports television, because I didn't get into this business because I love television. I got into this business because I couldn't play center field for the Yankees or, number three forward for the Knicks or something like that. That's what I really would have loved to do. So as a kid growing up, when I realized that pretty early, I really kind of fixated on watching games on television and back then listening to games on the radio. And I thought for me, that would be a way I could stay connected to sports. And then in the game, you have to love, there's all kinds of producers and televisions or people who do the studio shows, which is totally different, because during the show, you're basically working off a script. And unless breaking news happens, not a lot is going to vary on that script. In remote television or game production, there's a script for the first segment of the show, and then you have ideas of how you want to cover things and what you want to talk about, but the game can go in an entirely different direction, and then you have to be able to react to that. So you have to love, I don't want to say the word chaos, but you have to love the action, because there's a lot of action and a lot of decisions that are going to be being made almost every 5 seconds of the show. Okay, what are we going to do next? What should we talk about next? What should we show next? What is the editorial direction that should occur next?
In an interview I saw you give, I don't remember when it was, but just in doing preparation for today, You talked about just how many hours you will put in during a regular work week, regular and you know NFL regular season, and it was something into the it was over 100, which was pretty
110,
which is kind of crazy if you sort of break that down. So that means obviously that your job is not even a Thursday to Sunday job. Your job is a Sunday to Sunday job.
Correct.
So as specific as you can, starting with Monday, the day after you guys have broadcast your night game, take the listener through what you do. So start with Monday, and if you can, take it all the way up to Sunday night when kickoff comes.
Well, the first thing I do is check the ratings of the Sunday night
right.
game.
Welcome to television.
What's that?
I said welcome to television.
Yeah, so that's the first thing I do. But really what I do at that point is I try to read as many articles about what happened to the two teams in my next game and their game Sunday. So, you know, I'll just go through the internet and the papers and see what happened, see what's been said, try to check out some of the highlights from their games. But then I spend probably about, 4 hours critiquing the game we just did, for everyone. So, for the announcers, for Drew, for the production team, for the technical team, for myself, you're starting to, you go back and watch the show with a very critical eye, figure out what worked, what didn't. What can be improved, what absolutely must be improved, and, have that because we're going to have a discussion about that on Wednesday. So, so that takes about 4 hours. I'm also a dad and I have a daughter, so I have to try to figure out, some time with her in there. And normally I'm grading that game when the Monday night game is on, unless there's a team in the Monday night game that's in my Sunday game, and then I'll grade the tape. On Tuesday. Tuesday is my day where I really, make contact with the teams, speak to Al, speak to Chris, talk about the broadcast a little bit, speak to Drew. And then what I also try to do on Tuesday is watch the network broadcast of the two teams in my coming game on Sunday, their last game. So, I'll watch the Fox broadcast if it's an NFC team, the CBS broadcast if it's an AFC team, and just kind of see how that game got played, what they talked about, if there was something, that they might have missed that I think is, really relevant or somebody emerged out of that game. So, that's 2-3-hour games. So that's 6 hours. And then we have a call with our research team and the graphic team to talk about what beyond the obvious we may want to try to dig into this week. So, the thing that makes our game it makes it great, but it also makes it challenging. We have a lot of the same teams three times. So you really have to dig and think, about what can be brought out about the players of the teams that you're going to be covering. So that's about a 1 hour meeting. So you add up those hours there, you're talking, you're probably into the 12, 13 hours. Wednesday we do a conference, we do a staff meeting, and where we spend like the first 90 minutes reviewing the game we just did. Then we take the next 90 minutes and we look ahead to the game we're going to do and brainstorm ideas for that game. And then when that's over, we go Ken Hurt from Elias, who is our head research, he would have come back with all the answers to the questions and the thoughts that we had on Tuesday. So we do a meeting with that. That takes about an hour and a half. And then Chris at that point has narrated a tape on both teams in the upcoming game where he's talking about their schemes, individual players and their nuances and how he thinks this game is going to go from a football standpoint and a very XO standpoint. And those tapes, he does one for each team's offense and defense. They're about 45 minutes each. So, again, you can do the math on that. So, again, I'm probably, turning it out at about, 11 o'clock on Wednesday night. Thursday, head into the office. I'll have my meeting with Michelle Tafoya and Michelle Froman, who's her producer, where we discuss, some of the things that she can add to the show for this game, based on being on the field and based on, her repertorial skills and not having to learn, 63 players. She's got a different job. So we kind of discuss, okay, where do we point Michelle this week, you know, in terms of how we're going to cover this game. And then, you know, we fly out to the city where the game's being held. Friday, we go to practice. After practice, we'll meet with the head coach, the quarterback, and probably two other players, go back to the hotel, and then I'll take the coach's film, and I'll take Drew, my replay producer, my package producer, and a couple of the younger people on the show, and we'll watch the coach's film from that team's last game, and that's basically to understand what their schemes are and how their schemes are going to impact our isolation plan. So we'll, you know, we'll spend 2 hours on the offense, 2 hours on the defense. We'll do a little bit of a production meeting that night just to kind of get everybody squared away for the weekend, and then try to have a little bit of a team dinner with Al and Chris and Michelle, Drew, myself, a few of the other production people. On Saturday, we repeat that film process for the visiting team. So we'll get that same group of people gathered back again, watch the coach's film of the last game of the visiting team. It's a division game. We'll also watch the film of their last division game. And then by that time, I have my final meeting with Michelle Tafoya just to kind of figure out what she's going to do in the open, and Michelle Froman as well, and just really make sure that, okay, here's the stories we set out to research. Here's what I've come back with. Here's what how I want to deliver them. This is I'm speaking for Michelle here.
Right.
And then we make our little tweaks. Then we head out to the visiting team's hotel for their arrival and meet with the head coach, the quarterback, probably two other players. And then I go back to my room and try to take all that week's worth of preparation and figure out how it's going to flow into this broadcast. So I try to turn it out by midnight on Saturday night. Sunday, we have an editorial meeting, which is Drew, the announcers, obviously myself, and a few other key production people, where we just kind of openly discuss, you know, what we think the big stories of the game are going to be and how we're going to cover them, and that goes on for about 90 minutes. Then we bring in the entire production crew, and they have a they have tapes of the graphics and all the other video elements that could make the broadcast that night, and we all watch it together. And then the announcers leave. I do a quick meeting with the production crew. We head out to the stadium. We do a two-hour technical rehearsal. We eat lunch. Drew and I then conduct a one-hour camera and replay EBS meeting where we basically say, here are the stories of the game. Here are the things you guys need to look for. Here's how we're going to cover them. Hey, we're changing the replay sequences this week because of this team does this. And then by that time, the announcers are there. Teams are getting onto the field. Before you know it, it's 8:19 and we're ready to go.
That's fascinating. I appreciate it. That's really specific and appreciated. How many people are part of the sort of the traveling unit, Fred, that go from stadium to stadium each week?
Well, each week there's probably, I'm going to say there's probably about 100 to 150 people when you talk about the technical crew, the production crew, the operations crew, the people who, you know, work on the trucks and drive the mobile units across America. There's probably anywhere between 100 and 150 who actually go to every single game. On the production crew, there's of the main production crew that, you know, works out of Stamford where NBC's headquarters are, you know, my team is about 14 strong.
I got two questions on your announcers. First question is, you know, obviously, given what I do, I've talked to thousands of broadcasters. Some are good with constructive feedback. Some are awful with constructive feedback. How are Chris Collinsworth and Al Michaels, two people who have done, you know, at this point, hundreds, thousands of football games, how are they when the production people like yourself tell them, listen, I think this could be better, or I think maybe we should go this direction?
I mean, they're all receptive. I mean, I think the one thing, you know, I think the one thing we all, the one philosophy we all share is that no matter how good we are or how good we've been or what we've done, no one's ever done the perfect show, right? So there's always going to be room to improve. Now, I don't sit there and, like, nitpick them to a fine, you know, fine-tooth comb, but I'll just say, hey, look, you know, this story, we probably should have done this way. Or they've got feedback from me too. Like they'll say, hey, you know, why that decision there or something like that. But they're pretty good. I mean, they want to be good. They want the show to be good, and it's usually a pretty healthy discussion. And sometimes, you know, I, not being in their shoes, I'm not thinking about, okay, here's why he did this. And, you know, they'll come back to me and say, look, here's what I was thinking. This is what I thought you wanted, or this is what I thought was best, or I couldn't get to it because of this. And Michelle the same way. You know, Michelle's job's a lot harder because she's only on, you know, sometimes, you know, she might be on as little as three times a game.
Right.
You know, so now when you're on three times a game, this is a really unfair expectation, but the expectation is you're going to bat 1,000, you know. Well, I'm not setting 1,000 as the goal for Al or Chris or myself or Drew or anybody else, but, you know, Michelle's a real pro, and she takes it, you know, very, very seriously, and, you know, she gets the role, you know. I mean, she knows, depending on what's happening, she can be on a tremendous amount or she could be on three times, you know. And so they're really pretty good at it. Again, you know, we've been together so long that, you know, like I said, I'm not, like, fine-picking it, you know, to the nth degree because they're speaking for 3 hours, you know. It's really something that, to me, would stand out as, hey, not their standard or not our standard or a mistake, and say, look, this was a mistake, you know. Nothing we can do about it now, but I just want to point it out to you so we don't repeat it.
On a chemistry or interpersonal basis, how important is it for you to like your broadcasters in your position?
Well, I would say it's immensely important because, you know, we're traveling, you know, once we kick off September 10th, you know, we're traveling for like 20 straight weeks together. I mean, it's another family. I mean, truly is another family. So, you know, think about living with people you don't like. You know, it doesn't do a lot for you. And think about living with people you don't like when you're working 100 hours a week, because I'm not the only person doing that. Mm-hmm. So I think it's immensely important. I think it's immensely important that everybody gets along. And look, we all have our moments, you know. It's like any other family. There's bickering at times, you know. Somebody's not happy with somebody at times. But everybody really likes and enjoys one another. And it's the road family. That's one of the things about this business.
Do you think Sunday Night Football is the best presentation of the National Football League?
You know, I leave that for people like you, Rich. I think we'd have to be in that conversation. You know, I think that we work really hard at it. I think that, you know, people have talked about us in that realm. I know we've won a few awards, you know, over the years. But, you know, as good as it is, Rich, honestly, I mean, as good as it might be, or as good as you may think it is, or somebody at home, you always leave there knowing that it could have been better, you know, and that's one of the frustrating parts about television is that, you know, so many decisions are being made on the fly, and yes, there's a lot of preparation that's behind those decisions, but there's, you know, there's always a handful at the end of the night where you could have made a better decision, or instead of doing this, you could have done that, you know, and you have to live with that all the time, so...
The NFL season is less than a month away, and our new sponsor, FanDuel, is as excited as we are to kick off another year of action. Now, you've probably heard of FanDuel somewhere before. It's one of the most talked about new fantasy sites out there. Here's what it's all about. FanDuel is the leader in one-week fantasy football with more winners and more payouts than any other site. They will pay out over $75 million a week this football season. Look, we all love fantasy football. It certainly can be frustrating, I'll say that. But a lot of fans miss out because the entire season is just too much time commitment. So FanDuel does away with all that. You can draft a fresh team anytime and drop into tournaments for weekly cash prizes. Entry fees start at just $1. So go to FanDuel.com, click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner, use the code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, and sign up now. Now, there's a special offer. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it up to $200 that gets earned as you play. So that's a bonus of up to $200. The offer is only good for the first 50 people that use the code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A. So don't get left out. Again, don't forget to use the code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A. FanDuel.com, where every day is a new season. That's FanDuel, F-A-N-D-U-E-L.com. Try it out today.
Fred, NBC does not pay the most money for their NFL schedule, yet your NFL schedule is, I think by most accounts, consistently the best schedule of all the networks. How much are you aided in terms of reputation based on the quality of the games you get, independent of how you produce those games?
I mean, I think it's aided tremendously, Rich. Let's think about the beginning. We're heading into our 10th season now. You know, in 2006, you know, for the previous 36 years, you know, the big primetime game was played on Monday night. I mean, the entire country was, that was ingrained, you know, across America. And the league decided that they wanted Sunday night to be the night because that would provide them more flexibility. If a game that was scheduled in April fell apart in December, they could do something about it. So we had, you know, so that had to change. And really, the big impetus behind that change was, hey, we're going to put the most attractive games now on Sunday Night Football. So whether it was the Manning Bowl, you know, which was the first Sunday Night Football game ever, a bunch of Brady Mannings, and, you know, all those great rivalry games, you know, Cowboys Giants, Pittsburgh Baltimore, San Francisco Seattle. I mean, without the marquee, Rich, I did Sunday Night Football at ESPN from 1990 to 2000. You know, if we had an attractive game, it was a mistake. I mean, truly was a mistake. It was like two teams that you didn't think were going to be good, all of a sudden were really good. And it happened. It didn't even happen once a year. It might have happened once every couple of years. I mean, the Cowboys were the best team in the NFL from, 1992 to probably 1997. We didn't have one Sunday night Cowboy game in that time period. So we saw what Sunday night football was in a different iteration, and now we see what it is now. And without those really attractive matchups, you would not be talking to me right now.
Let me ask you, you worked at ESPN for, 13 years, 15 years? 19 years, okay. Am I correct, by the way, that at what point early in your production assistant career you drove Dick Vitale around?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was my first 6 months at ESPN were spent in the mailroom, and I had replaced George Bodenheimer, which is pretty funny.
Wow.
And when you were in the mailroom at ESPN, other than delivering mail, you were driving people to and from the airport. So I used to pick up Dick Vitale all the time.
And what were those conversations like between, 23-year-old Fred Godelli and 97-year-old Dick Vitale?
It's really funny because, I loved college basketball when I was a kid. I mean, I would, stay home on Saturday and watch the ECAC game of the week. I loved college basketball. And when I grew up with, guys like Bucky Waters and Al McGuire, right. And those people. And while Al and Billy Packer, Al was a little zany, he kind of stayed to the game. And Dick, I remember the first time I heard Dick, I was like, who is this guy? He's nuts. So I picked him up at the airport, and, he was the way he is on the air. I mean, that's how he is. So he gets in the car, he's yelling, he's screaming, spit flying out of his mouth, and I really didn't know what to make of him. Now, we've become, great friends. I love Dick, but in the beginning, I was looking at him somewhat askance because I really couldn't figure out if this was an act or if this is who he truly was or is, and it was the latter.
How good a driver were you?
I was good enough. I mean, I got to tell you, driving was interesting because you got to meet a lot of good people.
Right.
I mean, I remember driving Steve Bornstein.
Wow.
I used to drive Scotty Connell a ton, Greg Gumbel. I remember the late Dick Houser. And there were always people that would give you, some pretty good advice if you were listening, And so I would not trade the way I started for anything. It was just a great experience. You got to know people in the company. And you really kind of get to know what people are like when you're in the mailroom, because if people are nice to you and you're in the mailroom, they're probably pretty nice people.
Correct, yeah. I mean, the rule of thumb basically is if you treat someone like a production assistant, or in my world, like an intern, well, you're generally a good person. If you treat them poorly, you're the asshole, not them.
Correct.
I want to ask you something about a couple things about ESPN, because this is interesting to me. You know, there was a certain decision that ESPN made when they essentially allowed you and Drew Esikoff to go from ESPN to NBC. They had a shot at Al Michaels and John Madden being on their broadcast. So the question would be, and I realize it's self-serving, but had you and Drew and Al and John been the ESPN NFL team, do you think we would be in this situation today where NBC has the marquee games as opposed to ESPN having the marquee game?
Well, I don't think anything would have stopped NBC from having the marquee games. That's what they bought. You know, that's what Paul Tagliabue sold to Dick Ebersole. So I don't think that would have stopped NBC from having the marquee games. Would NBC have been as good? I mean, that's debatable. I'm not sure where Dick would have turned, and I've never even asked him that question. You know, like, hey, what would have happened if ABC just said they were keeping all of us, or ESPN said they were keeping all of us? But I don't think it would have affected their schedule. Now, might the league have been a little more leaning toward giving ESPN some better games? Maybe. I don't know. But I do know that of all the bosses I've had connected to the National Football League, there was no one who took the schedule more seriously, and it showed, than Dick Ebersole. He worked that thing every single day of the year.
No doubt.
And so, yeah, NBC still would have had the schedule. Maybe Monday night would have had some better games.
And say what you want about Ebersole, even in the Olympics, getting the swimming set in prime time, the guy's been he was a masterful in terms of getting the best schedule for his company, which ultimately was his job.
I mean, the other stuff doesn't matter. I mean, like I said, if you took the Sunday night team, you know, and put them on, you know, a regional NFL telecast, I mean, yeah, maybe the people in those markets would get it, but, you know, the rest of America wouldn't see it. So it has to be both. You know, I mean, you have to have the great attraction that people want to see, and then you have to have the people that can really, you know, bring it to life.
All right, I'm going to ask this question knowing full well that it's a hard one for the subject to answer because you don't want to come off looking like a self-serving clown. But the author of the ESPN oral history, Jim Miller, those guys have all the fun, said that ESPN losing you was one of the biggest personnel mistakes in ESPN history. What is your thought upon hearing that?
I mean, obviously, I don't think there's anyone who, you know, I mean, hey, it makes you feel good. I mean, whether it's factual or not, you know, you'd have to, you know, ask, you know, the hierarchy at ESPN. But,
right.
You know, look, at the end of the day, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. You know, I mean, they decided that, you know, they didn't want Drew and I on football. You know, at that time, they said, hey, we'd love you to be our NASCAR team. And, you know, there were other events that were offered up. But, you know, at that point in my career, after having done, you know, 16 seasons of NFL football, 2 Super Bowls, and, you know, the original Monday Night Football, I just didn't see how anything else was going to be, you know, as satisfactory. It would have been, you know, moving, you know, at best, you know, laterally, but laterally heading south. So when Monday night, you know, didn't happen, you know, I set my sights on how do I get to know Dick Ebersole, you know, and lucky enough that happened.
I mean, but there has to be a part of you, is there not, that maybe it's lessened now because we're talking 10 years later, but was there a part of you when you went to NBC that was like, I want to make this production so much better than my former place's NFL production?
Rich, I would say for about 5 years, I woke up every morning saying, how can I beat the hell out of ESPN? I mean, I'll be honest with you. I mean, I just felt like the decision-making in that regard, and this is nothing against Jay Rothman. I really like Jay Rothman. I think he's great. But I just felt like the decision-making there was, like, really flawed and skewed and, for me, not understandable. And, yeah, I wanted to make ESPN pay every single day.
So what changed after the five-year mark?
Made him pay. You know, we did what we did. And look, that Monday Night Football is an excellent production. I mean, it really is. I mean, I enjoy it. It's really good. It's not like, oh, my God, we killed them. But I would just say how Sunday Night Football, for all the reasons we're talking about, Dick Ebersol, the schedule, you know, the way that that just took off like a rocket and became the number one show in prime time, you know, now four straight years. I mean, you know, we did it. Now, do I think it could be better? Yeah, I think it can be better. You know, I'm hoping it's going to be better this year than it was last year. But, you know, after a while, and then, Rich, you get older, you know. I mean, it's like, hey, does this really matter?
Right.
You know, you did it. You know, or, you know, you're doing it. And, but yeah, that was a feeling for a long time.
I appreciate you answering that. I want to ask you some specifics about things that have happened within games. And let's start with last year's Super Bowl. Because,
right,
as you said, the moment of truth last year was Malcolm Butler's interception. And I remember talking to you right after the game. And one of the interesting things that I remembered that you said was, you know, once you show the interception, after that it's about reaction. And that those reaction shots can be the difference between people remembering this was a great broadcast versus, they're going to remember the Butler play, but maybe the broadcast doesn't stand out. So, you know, you had Brady's reaction and Pete Carroll's reaction, and Chris Collinsworth was on point there. That's going to go down 100 years from now as one of the most memorable moments in Super Bowl history. Do you think the production got that moment right? And if they did, how so?
Well, yeah. I mean, I do think the production got it right. I'll tell you in a second how it could have got it better. Look, no one is expecting the play or the outcome, right? I mean, okay, it could be a pass. You only have two things you can do, run or pass. But not we were having this conversation last night at dinner. Not that pass, you know. And, you know, not that outcome. So, you know, right away it's like, you know, you're hit with a lightning bolt, like, whoa, what just happened? And then you're just trying to figure out who are the parties involved in this, you know, gigantic turnaround of events, obviously Wilson and Butler. And then, okay, what are the ramifications of this? You know, so now you have Brady acting like he's 12 years old, like anybody would who just poured his heart out, you know, for the entire season, four quarters, and then being called a cheater for 2 weeks.
Right.
You know, you have Pete Carroll who made the call. You have Russell Wilson who threw the pass. You know, and you have all those things that you're trying to put together. And while it's happening, look, it's in your head. This is going down as one of the biggest moments in the history of the National Football League. It's in your head. You know it. So you now have to react accordingly, knowing this is going to be seen forever, and you have to put your best foot forward. So, you know, I thought that all our guys, you know, the camera people, the replay people, Drew, Al, Chris, I mean, and even Michelle at the end of the game running down Butler, you know, I just think that, you know, everybody rose to the occasion and was equal to the moment.
So how would it have been better?
Well, you know, it's funny because when you go back and you watch the play, the guy who really makes the play is Brandon Browner, because Brandon Browner gets such a great jam on Jermaine Kearse that Lockett, who's now trying to come across, has to take a little bit of a flatter route. And right, that flatter route is what lets Butler get between him and the ball and make the pick. So if Browner doesn't play it as tough as he plays it, I'm guessing Lockett takes a more, you know, is able to angle his route the way, you know, on a 45-degree angle as opposed to maybe a 30-degree angle, and Butler can't get there. And, you know, look, that's football, that's X and O, that's easy to do after the game. But, you know, maybe somewhere, not in that replay sequence, but somewhere before we got off, it might have been good just to mention, hey, you know, Browner was a huge part in making this play happen.
And you're someone who you're very much about away from the ball, right? You want the viewer to understand how important things happen away from the ball.
Right. Yeah, I mean, look, there's 22 guys out there, and, you know, people, when you watch football, you have to watch the ball because you're not gonna understand the game. But there are so many things that happen for that play to be successful, and, you know, there's players who have gone to, you know, 9 or 10 Pro Bowls who play guard. okay, well, this guy is known as a star player. You're not going to really understand what he does by watching the ball, right? So when you have those types of players in the game or, you know, things are happening, you know, you see people running through wide open holes. Well, yeah, he's a really good running back, but, you know, no great running back, you know, can run through a wall. So, yeah, to me, it's really, really important. And I think it's a lot more interesting at home, you know, when people are talking about things away from the ball as a reason why things are working or not working.
All right, let me ask you about another game, and you know this is going to come up. New England, Baltimore last January, Al Michaels reads a statement that lauds Roger Goodell's integrity in the Ray Rice case, the Mueller report.
Right.
Let me read you a couple things. Here's Bill Simmons on that moment. I like Collinsworth and Michaels, but come on, that was like listening to Michael Cole and JBL praising Vince McMahon. David Zurawak of the Baltimore Sun. It had the look of something you might have expected from state-run TV in an Eastern European country in the 1950s. Goodell as Marshall Tito and Michaels and Collinsworth as his fawning puppet announcers. You don't often get Marshall Tito references, so that's nice there. Washington Post talked about corporate PR.
You called it Pravda.
I called it Pravda, kissing up to the guys who decides the broadcast. All right, so there was, as you know, there was a lot of criticism for that,
right,
including from myself, where all the people who were critical of what they thought was a total Pravda job by NBC, incorrect.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, those were one, I mean, I would say that was one thing we probably could have done better, you know, and in my desire to try to spew only the facts, it became a little bit too academic, and it came off like we were reading a script. Whereas, if I just would have said, "Hey, let's play this," I don't want to use the word casual, but a little less, you know, using. I wanted to use the words of the Mueller report, so they weren't our words. You know what I'm saying? So I didn't want it to be like, "Hey, we're doing a testimony here," you know, for Commissioner Goodell or whomever. I want, hey, we're just going to quote the report, and this way all we're doing is quoting a report. And by making it, you know, to the script of the report, it came off like it was a script. And I really take the blame for that. If I had to do it over, I probably would have spent less time. I would have, I think I just would have said, Al, just say, hey, Mueller report came out yesterday, found that there were the Ravens definitely had some missteps in how they handled the case. Exonerated Goodell, didn't find any evidence of a package on Park Avenue, but laid out steps where the NFL has to be better in terms of handling disciplinary action at the league level. I felt like we had to address it, and I was so concerned about everything, you know, the criticism you just read to me, that I was like, I think the way to avoid the criticism is to just use the verbiage from the report. And it would have been better the other way.
Here's the larger question. You are a partner with the NFL, as ESPN is, as CBS is, as Fox is. How critical on your broadcast can you really be of someone like Roger Goodell?
I mean, I think you can be critical. I think you can be critical when, you know, there are mistakes and missteps. Now, you know, sometimes, you know, you have information that you have gathered that, unfortunately, as you would, you know, this term off the record, that somebody says, hey, look, this is what really happened, but you can't use this, but you have some knowledge of it. But, you know, I've never heard a word from the league about anything we've ever done that might shine a negative light on them.
Hmm.
You know, if it was wrong, I might hear a word. But I'm trying to think of an example now, and I can't really think of one on the top of my head. But, you know, look, can we be as freewheeling as Bill Simmons? No. You know, of course not. But, you know, obviously ESPN didn't think they could be either because he's no longer there.
Correct.
But, you know, there's no question it's a delicate balance, but I could tell you, Roger Goodell has never called me and said, hey, what you did was wrong, or why'd you do that, or any of his, you know, assistants or people like that at the league level.
All right, we're going to finish. I'm going to keep you for another 6 or 7 minutes, and we'll get you out of here. A couple quick ones. You worked with Dennis Miller in the booth of Monday Night Football, correct?
Correct.
That's,
1 year.
That was always an interesting experiment to me as someone who produces, you know, the showcase broadcast of the NFL. Can you see in the next 10, 15, 20, 25 years a non-traditional person like a Dennis Miller coming back and being an analyst?
You know, it's a good question. You know, I think when I look back at my year with Dennis Miller, you know, if there was one major thing I could do over was I think I would have told Dennis Miller to show up Monday morning and not be a part of, you know, the meetings with the coaches and the players and the prep. Because what I think happened there was it really dulled his sword. He got to see that Tom Coughlin's a really good guy. You know, he got to meet all the players and all these, you know, when you're sitting on a couch and a guy throws a pick and you want to rip him, it's easy. But when you know the guy and you saw the work that he put in all week, you don't want to rip him.
Right.
You know, when I say rip him, make fun of him, make a joke about him, whatever, okay? So I think if I had to do it again with Dennis, you know, I would, you know, I would say, hey, show up on Monday and this way your sword won't be dulled. I also would have tried harder to convince him we wanted to do weekend update at halftime on the news of the NFL weekend, you know, and he would have been great, obviously, and that I think would have been something people would have loved to have seen, but he wasn't into it. I think when you bring somebody from outside the norm or from outside the immediate culture of that sport, it's just going to be a really hard sell for the people who are, you know, the real fans of that sport. They look at it as a gimmick. They don't take it seriously. You know, even a guy like Tony, you know, Tony Kornheiser, who obviously, you know, great sports journalist, all that, you know, it's different. You know, it's different writing a column, you know, where you don't meet anybody or go to the locker room or those types of things and now have to speak for 3 hours extemporaneously. It's not the same. And I think the I don't even use the word hardcore, but I would say I would just think the regular fan base doesn't buy the outsider.
That's an interesting point.
I think Ohlmeyer, that was a genius move.
The Kornheiser one or the Dennis Miller one?
The Dennis Miller one. I mean, it was so out of left field. I mean, Don was trying to, you know, as he put it, breathe new life into Monday Night Football and get people talking about it again. And he did exactly that.
True.
You know, and I thought Miller was a tremendous idea. And I think, you know, Don had told me this one time. He never saw it as a long-term answer. He saw it as a way to get America talking about Monday Night Football again, and they sure did.
All right. Three more questions left. We'll make this quick. One of the things I always respect about your broadcast is, whether it's Andrea Kramer or Michelle Tafoya, you want reportage and journalism instincts and journalists, quite frankly, as your sideline people. That is not the case with all of your competitors. Why do you think that is? I think your broadcast has made it clear that the sideline reporter is there to be a reporter. On other broadcasts, it seems like the sideline reporter is there to be part of the celebrity of the show.
Well, I could speak for hours. We're trying to provide the highest quality of production we can for the National Football League. And, you know, Michelle or Andrea, you know, they're down there for a reason. They have a vantage point that no one else, that Al or Chris or John Madden before him, you know, didn't have. They also don't have the same preparation responsibilities. I mean, look, Michelle has to know, obviously, you know, the players and all that, but their preparation is different. And I think that's good. And I think that, you know, for me, you want to be adding information to the telecast. You don't want to be distracting from what's going on in the field. So I want it to be additive, you know, not the opposite of that. And I just feel like there's always, you know, injuries are a big part of what we do. Substitution is a big part of what we do. There are stories within, you know, that need to be told, whether, you know, they're personal and they relate to what is just going on in the field. So, I mean, that's where we try to hang our hat, and, you know, I've had two of the best, no doubt.
All right, finally, you've been in many, many production meetings over the last, certainly over the last decade with NBC, but beyond that with ESPN and ABC as well. In your conversations with coaches and players, talking about current coaches and players, who stands out, in your opinion, as somebody who, if they took it seriously, could walk into the network broadcasting level in the studio or on a game broadcast and really, really hit it out of the park?
All right, well, I'll just give you the decision we had to make last year. So we're getting ready for the wild card game, and it's Pittsburgh and Baltimore, and I love Mike Tomlin. I just think Mike Tomlin has a way of phrasing things, has an energy about him that would make him great on television, no doubt. And he probably would be my number one guy. But then the Ravens come in, and we meet with Harbaugh, and I know Harbaugh over the years, but now I've got this kind of TV thing in my mind because we're trying to hire a coach for the Super Bowl, and I want it to be Tomlin if they don't make it to the Super Bowl. So I've got this in my head. So we go meet the Ravens, and now we sit down with Harbaugh, and I'm listening. And I'm like, God, Harbaugh, he'd be great too. So I call up Sam Flood. I said, look, here's my recommendation because it's ultimately his call. I said, I think we get the loser of this game and offer him the job at the Super Bowl. So he's like, okay, that's a great idea because let's do that. So Steelers lose Monday morning. I call them. And I said, hey, I'd like to speak to Coach Tomlin. I called the PR man, Bert Lauten. I said, Bert, I'd like to speak to Coach Tomlin about, you know, working the Super Bowl for us. And he comes back and he said, hey, Mike said, thanks a lot. He's really not interested. I'm like, man, can I just talk to him? He goes, well, they're in their evaluations and all this stuff. I said, please ask him to call me. Well, he never really called me back. So I'm like, all right, well, he's not going to do it. I think he would be great. I mean, great, great, great. But then when we had Harbaugh the next week in that Patriot game you mentioned, and they lost, and on Monday morning I called their PR man, Kevin Byrne. I said, look, we'd love to have John. We think he'd do a great job. And I'll get back to you. He goes, hey, John's interested. He wants to know if he's the first choice. I started laughing. I said, look, I'm going to tell you exactly what happened. We decided it would be the loser of that wild card game. Mike didn't want to do it. We think John would be great. You know, would he do it? And then John came on, and I think you would agree, Rich, John was fantastic on the Super Bowl.
He was excellent. What about
I think those are two guys I would say would really, really be good.
Is there a player that stands out?
You know, it's interesting on the player. I think Aaron Rodgers would probably be pretty good. I don't have the conviction about any player that I have about Tomlin and Harbaugh.
That's interesting. And that says something. All right, Fred Godelli is the coordinating producer of NBC's Sunday Night Football. He has been in that position for, I think, 10 years or so. That is the number one show on television, depending on how you want to spin the Walking Dead ratings. It is either one or two. But this is the preeminent football broadcast, and Fred Godelli is in the big chair for that. He's got an interesting job, and he's always been very, very generous with his time when it comes to Sports Illustrated. I think what he does is really fascinating. And so, Fred, I know you are about to deal with the television critics. Usually those consist of the critics, I believe, going up and hugging you on stage. So I hope that will work out very nicely for you.
I'm going to see your man Koblen, though.
John Koblen. I like it. Yeah. That's correct. Your former Deadspinner, now New York Times bon vivant. So please send him my best. All right, Fred Godelli has been the guest on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Fred, thanks so much for your time. Have a great season. I'm sure I will talk to you during the year.
Enjoyed it, Rich. Thank you.
So our new sponsor, SeatGeek, has an app that makes it easy to find a great deal, pay for tickets, and get to your seat. And for listeners to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, you can use the promo code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, in the SeatGeek app and get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase. It takes less than a minute to download, and the app is free. Just like you can consolidate flight and hotel options online, SeatGeek pulls in ticket options from hundreds of online ticket sellers to create a one-stop shop for sports and concert tickets. So when you shop on SeatGeek, you're seeing virtually every ticket option for that next game, all on one page, no need to go anywhere else. Also, they have this great feature called Deal Score and ranks every ticket on the market with a 1 to 100 value score, plots the best deals for you on a color-coded interactive map of the venue so you can easily identify the best value in the building. Finally, SeatGeek's mobile app makes the ticket buying process seamless, easy, and reliable. You can store your credit card, and once you find a ticket you want to buy, you complete the purchase with just two quick taps. There is
no faster way to buy tickets. All right, to redeem your promo code and save $20 on tickets, download the free SeatGeek app today, enter promo code media in the app. SeatGeek will then send you $20 once you've made your first SeatGeek purchase. If you want to go to a stadium today, that is the app to hit.
All right, back in the studio with producer Bette Marston. My thanks to Fred Godelli of NBC Sports for his time. He has a very, very interesting job. Premier producing job in the NFL. Obviously, CBS and Fox and ESPN all have their A crews in number one, but this is the showcase game for the league. And I thought he was, I think, Bette, what was really interesting to me, the conversation was interesting to me, but when he went through his week, and he was very, very specific about what he did from Monday to Sunday, you really get a sense of why this production is as good as it is, because of the amount of work that he and his team do on a weekly basis. And this is a, you know, whatever it is, 19, 21-week job. So that was pretty impressive to hear in that kind of detail.
Right. These guys seemingly never take their eyes off football news. I mean, they... You know, if you miss even a day of news, you feel like you're behind and you're trying to play catch up and trying to, and you don't have enough time to formulate your own opinion, and you're trying to, you know, read what everyone else has said and trying to, you know, go from there. So
I like the fact that he is pretty honest about ESPN. Basically woke up every day for 5 years wanting to kick their butt.
Yeah,
but you know,
it's good. You want that type of fire in a producer. That's what
you
want.
Yeah, and quite frankly, they screwed up. I mean, it's essentially... Drew Eskoff and Fred Godelli are considered the best of what they do. Madden and Michaels, obviously, two legendary people. I don't know what that sound was. Two legendary people in the business, and ABC/ESPN let them jet to another network, and now that network is number one. All right, so thank you very much for all your support of this podcast. If you would like to reach me for comments, guest suggestion, hit me up on Twitter at Richard Deitch, RichardDeitsch. You can hit Bette Marston up on Twitter as well. I think that's her name, BetteMarston with the at. We'll have some really good guests coming up as we head forward. Katie Nolan coming up, Susie Kolber, Mike Hill of Fox Sports. Down the road in October, the great Paul Heyman of the WWE. So some very good guests are coming up. We appreciate all the support. Please check us out on iTunes under the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast as well. Okay, for Fred Godelli of Sunday Night Football on NBC Sports, for Bette Marston, my producer, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one daily sports podcast network? Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.